underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. A naturalist and advocate for freedom of speech, Terry Tempest Williams explores how environmental issues are social issues and ultimately matters of justice. Her new book, The Hour of Land, A Personal Topography of America's National Parks, comes with the centennial of the National Park Service. It is a celebration of our national parks and an exploration of what they mean to us and what we mean to them. Tempest is the author of 15 other books, including Refuge, An Unnatural History of Family and Place, An Unspoken Hunger, Stories from the Field, Finding Beauty in a Broken World, and When Women Were Birds. She is a columnist for The Progressive and has written for The New Yorker, The New York Times, and Orion magazines, among others. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Terry Tempest Williams to this week's book show. How are you?
Hi, Joe. I love you. I'm great. And well, thank you for having me on your show.
I love you right back. It's always wonderful to talk to you. One of the reasons I enjoy talking to you is because you are a writer who is able to very, very much talk about the process and of you as a human being and writing that and getting that on the page. Given that this particular book is so personal and is about a topic that is so personal to so many of us, I'm interested in what led you down that path.
You know, I thought this would be the easiest book to write because it focuses on the lands that I love the most, our public lands, our national parks, breathing spaces in a country where I feel we are increasingly holding our breath. In truth, Joe, it was the hardest book I've done. And I think it's because I realized very quickly I was writing out of my limitations. I'm not a scientist. I'm not a historian. I don't work for the federal government. I'm not an attorney schooled in these legal issues. And so I think as any writer must do, you have to ask yourself, by what authority do I write? And in this particular book, I realized the authority by which I write is out of my own heart, and I'm a storyteller, and that's what this book is, stories.
And in those stories, where did you want to begin? What was the starting place for you?
Would you believe me if I told you I imagined this book as a dinner party? We have 12 seats around our table mm-hmm. in Castle Valley, Utah, in the desert, and I thought, you know, who do you have at the head of the table? And for me, I chose the two parks that I know the best, that I can count on, my Mother Park, Grand Teton National Park in Wyoming, and Canyonlands National Park in Utah, where we live. And then you think, okay, who am I putting in the center? And they were the parks that I knew, but I wish I knew better, but I knew they were trustworthy. Acadia National Park in Maine, and Theodore Roosevelt National Park in North Dakota. And then you think, okay, who are the interesting guests? Who are the guests that make people uncomfortable? And I immediately thought Gettysburg, war, Alcatraz, prison, and the Gulf Islands National Seashore that just went through the BP oil spill. I thought about those guests I didn't know, but I always wanted to know, but I knew people who did know them that could invite them and enter in Gates of the Arctic in Alaska, the least visited national park in the system, and Big Bend in Texas. And I can tell you, if I ever disappear, it will be there. There was the guest who came late, complicated. I was afraid of Glacier National Park. I didn't know if I could tell the story, intimidated by Glacier. The fact that deep betrayals to the Blackfoot Nation in its history a very shadowed history. The fact that the very namesake Glacier National Park now only has 15 remaining glaciers. It's now a park of great uncertainty. And then the guest who surprises you, and that was Cesar Chavez National Monument. And the one I didn't know was coming, and it was a last-minute invite, was Effigy Mounds in Iowa on the edge of the Mississippi River. Mounds in the shape of bears, wolves, snakes, and a falcon in the forest with a wingspan 200 feet wide that you walk with your feet and feel the spiritual power of that place.
Does the writing bring you to those, one after another, that unexpected guest? Is it the writing process that brings you to that park, or is it the actual travel to other parks that brings you to that place?
It was very pragmatic. You know, I have been thinking about this geography of hope that Wallace Stegner talks about in this country we call America, and I noticed that there was a big void in the center of the country, in the Midwest. Why? Largely because it's been plowed under. And there in the corner was Effigy Mounds. I had never heard of it, and I wanted to see it. And I would tell you that, honestly, it would be in my top five places of power that I have ever been. And an incredible Lakota man who is the cultural resource manager, Albert LeBeau, who spent a lot of time with me talking about these mounds and the native people and the Ho-Chunk, the Winnebago. And I was completely undone. And also the politics, again, another shadowed history that we hold. And I guess what I learned from this process, this book, would be when my mentor, Wallace Stegner, said, "Our national parks are our best idea," I would argue and say they are an evolving idea.
Terry Tempest Williams is our guest. The name of the new book is The Hour of Land. As you mentioned, you start off with Grand Teton National Park, which I believe personally is also my favorite national park. Is it because it is so personal, or what are the aspects of it that lure you there again and again?
Not a year of my life has been lived without seeing the Tetons, not one. As I said, it is my mother park. It's where my great-grandparents went, my grandparents, my parents. My father was called Teton Tempest when he was in college. On his 80th birthday, there were four generations present, my father being the elder and little Wyatt, who had just turned one. And on the day of my father's birthday, we hiked up to Grandview Point. And on the way down, I think there were 15 of us, probably an assault on the park and all the other visitors there. But when we got down to the end of the trail, we saw a grizzly, and it was standing upright. And our family stood out of respect, I think, to get a better view. The bear bolted, and my niece Callie said, "Happy birthday, John." It's those kinds of stories, Memory Palace. Brooke and I were married there. It was where we worked at the Teton Science School. It's bedrock. It's home ground. It's granite. And it's, as I get older, it's interesting. It's not the mountains that compel me to stay and to return. It's the sky, the clouds, the big weather.
What I found fascinating in the times that I've been to Grand Teton National Park is that in my mind, it's so often overshadowed by Yellowstone. And when you were there, it even seems like it's overshadowed by Yellowstone, because you keep on hearing from people who were either headed to Yellowstone or coming back from it and just seem to be there by chance, as opposed to making the conscious decision of I'm going there. Which was remarkable to me because it was such a spectacular place that connected with me, not to dismiss Yellowstone, but in a much deeper way than Yellowstone did.
It's a great point. You know, Yellowstone is unfathomable to me. It's large. It was our first national park. It's varied. It's, in many ways, it's a geothermal park. And yet the vast meadows, the backcountry, the wildlife. Grand Teton, I think, is much more intimate, even though the jagged range, a young mountain range, only 9 million years old. And yet, you know, as a Westerner, Joe, I really see them seamlessly as part of the greater Yellowstone ecosystem. And the borders are fluid, not fixed. And it's interesting to me to hear your perspective. And, you know, there is, I have to say, there is something about Yellowstone that is like no other. May I share a story with you?
Absolutely.
You know, Brooke and I share it, well, obviously we're married. We celebrated our 40th anniversary last year, and that in itself is miraculous. And both of us said to each other, where do we want to go? And immediately we both said Yellowstone. You know, not Paris, not Rio, you know, nothing more exotic than Yellowstone, our own backyard. And we went north. We went into a place called the Lamar Valley in the northern part of the park near Mammoth Hot Springs. We got up before dawn, that crepuscular time of day. The light lifted. We saw the mist rising over the Lamar River. And we saw this mound. And we put our binoculars on it, and clearly it was a bison carcass. You could see the bones glimmering, the rib cage. Suddenly, two coyotes emerged. Two eagles were also scavenging, and a flurry of ravens. A ranger came, gave us the backstory that the day before, this was a mother bison who was in the process of giving birth to a stillborn, suffering, in trouble. She wasn't going to make it. A wolf pack in the Lamar Valley took her down quickly. It was a violent death, predator prey. As we were hearing this story, the hackles on the coyotes rose. They vanished. The eagles flew. The ravens disappeared. And out of the lodgepole pine emerged this magnificent silver-gray wolf, alpha male. Entered the cavern of bones, disappeared. We saw the flanks. We saw his belly swell. He must have been in there for close to an hour. When he emerged, this bib of blood, he disappeared as quickly as he had appeared. Brooke and I left. We went on our day. We came back at twilight hoping we would see that wolf again. The bones, the mother bison, was there. Her ribcage picked clean. We noticed about a quarter of a mile away, 200 to 300 bison grazing, last light of day. Suddenly, seven bison created a line, single file, evenly spaced, and were walking over to the mother bison. They circled her. They circled her twice, nudged her body, pawed her body, sniffed her, tightened the circle one more time, lowered their heads, and then left, single file, evenly spaced, save one lone bull who stayed with her.
Obviously, witnessing that changes you in some way, right? I mean, it deeply impacts you. And as I make that statement, I turn it to a question, which is, you noticed it. Would all of us take the time to see what you saw and have it impact us in such a way?
That's the power of our national parks. That's the potency of our public lands. And I would say, yes, it is around us all the time. And so to see, to feel an experience like that, you know, you are reminded that we are not the only species that lives and dreams and loves on this planet. It's deeply humbling, and it does change us. And this is the world we live in that we have separated ourselves from. These are the lands that people in my state, my governor, you know, our congressional delegation, and for that matter, the Republican Party, are trying to destroy. And when I say that, you know, if you read the GOP political platform, it says, and I quote, as one of its major tenets, quote, to dispose of all federal lands, unquote. You know, our delegation is trying to take the public out of public lands. So to me, that's what's not being seen. You know, you see a wolf, you see the bison, you see the mountains like the Grand Tetons, you see Yosemite, you see the blue haze of mountain after mountain after mountain in the Great Smokies, or that rocky edge in Maine. We see that. We acknowledge that. We bow to that. But what I want to know is, what about the people that aren't seeing the value of this? And if you take out our national parks and monuments, if you take out our public lands, our public commons, what are we left with in this country?
And I guess my question that I asked you was fueled in part by an experience I had at Yellowstone, where there was a bear and its cub, and the young cub was running around maybe 100 feet from the road. And a car pulls over, and a mother and their child get out, and the mother directs the child to go near the cub so that she can get a picture. And moments later, a weary forest ranger gets out of his vehicle and mogs up to the mother and said, "No, you can't do that." And to me, that experience just put into perspective how we can screw these things up.
I mean, there's no question. And having worked for the Park Service years ago, you know, we all have those stories. You know, just recently there was the gentleman and his son who saw a baby bison, a bison calf, and it was cold, and they put it in the back of their vehicle.
Right.
You know, I can't tell you the times I've seen individuals taking pictures so close to a bison, or in the story you're telling, heaven forbid, a grizzly, and the bison are just as wild. You know, we've forgotten the wild. There's no question. And I think that's, again, the power of our national parks to educate us as a people who see nature films. It's all virtual. Or, you know, we think that a bear is a dog. I mean, seriously, that isn't wild and dangerous and certainly a sovereign among its own species. So it is disconcerting. And I think that's where our ecological literacy, I think, has waned.
I do want to touch on something that you mentioned early on in our conversation. That was about Glacier National Park and the issues there and writing about that park and of course its history, but also one that is changing, and it is a park that is in constant change. And having been there two or three times, it's a difficult park to navigate. It's difficult to see. You have to hit the right conditions, and it's a hard park to navigate and to understand. And it seems in reading the book that you continually have that issue.
Glacier is so powerful, and you know, we were just there, and again, I've been there half a dozen times. This time, I just literally fell to my knees on the edge of Lake McDonald. It's so beautiful. And, you know, it's a landscape that is in relationship with fire. The last time I was there, our family was almost killed by a perfect storm of three fires converging where we were at the Granite Park Chalet. It was only really by a shift of winds at the very last minute where the fires roared around us rather than over us. But, you know, the glaciers are melting, they're receding. The Blackfoot Nation, I am happy to say, when we talk about, you know, how our national parks are an evolving story, now when you are at the edge of Glacier at Lake McDonald, it is an international park. You see Canadian flag on one side. You see the American flag on the other. And in the center, in the place of honor, is the Blackfoot Nation flag. And there's an extraordinary superintendent named Jeffrey Moe, who is phenomenal. I wish he would be the next director of the National Park Service. And he now sees this park as a great teacher of ambiguity, of uncertainty, of how we find refuge in change. And I love that. And he sees, again, these borders aren't fixed but fluid, with Indian lands, with international lands, and with the local communities themselves, like Whitefish and Kalispell. So that if we're talking about climate change in Glacier National Park, then the communities also need to be involved in that conversation. So I was so moved by the kind of conversations that are happening there on the ground.
Terry Tempest Williams is our guest. The name of the book is The Hour of Land, A Personal Topography of America's National Parks. The wonderful thing about anniversaries is they give you a chance to take note and to do exactly what you have done. How much thinking did you allow yourself of the future, of what the next 100 years could bring to this park system?
I was very present with this book in the here and now. Certainly, I had to embrace the history of both shadow and light. And you can't help but think about the future. And I think what struck me was how difficult it is to establish a national park or monument. In the monument case, through the Antiquities Act of 1906, in establishing a national park, you need an act of Congress. But I think what hit me was, as hard as it is to establish these parks and monuments, the closest thing we have in my mind to sacred lands in this country, I think in the future it's going to be even more difficult to keep them. Because as the press of population increases, as corporate strangleholds take us in more commercialized directions, I think we as a people are going to have to really fight for wildness, both cultural and wild. So I did think about the future. I also thought a lot about this evolving idea that, you know, in 1916 you have a director of the National Park Service like Stephen T. Mather, who was a moneyed man, a privileged man, white man, made his fortune from borax and 20 mules strong. You know, his concerns were, how do we pay for these parks? And would Mrs. Astor be comfortable in Yosemite? In fact, she wasn't. He built the Ahwahnee Hotel, ironically named after the very people who were displaced by the park. And now it's no longer the Ahwahnee Hotel, but the Majestic Hotel, because the corporate name is now, well, Ahwahnee is now corporatized and is in a legal dispute over trademark, you know, an evolving idea. But I think the thing that interests me most in this evolving idea, and it is about the future, is you have a black president who was a community organizer, Barack Obama, who in 2012 honored another community organizer, Cesar Chavez, and created the Cesar Chavez National Monument. We have Stonewall National Monument, just established by the president a month ago, honoring the LGBT struggle and triumph there. You have the Harriet Tubman Underground Railroad National Monument. So we're seeing this evolution of diverse peoples, diverse histories, not just one story. 10 years ago, you could go to Gettysburg and never hear the word slavery mentioned in the national park interpretation. That has changed now. And the last thing I would say about the future is I think we're going to see very soon a new monument in Maine, Katahdin Woods and Water. I believe that will happen. I pray that we see the Bears Ears National Monument in Utah, which is a proposal led by five nations, Navajo, Hopi, Zuni, the two Ute nations, with 25 other Puebloan tribes supporting close to 2 million acres that they be set aside as home ground of indigenous people in the American Southwest, adjacent to Canyonlands National Park, that they are saying to President Obama, this is where the bones of our ancestors are. This is where their songs can still be heard, carried by the wind. Our ceremonies are performed here. Our medicines are held here. And what a wonderful offering of peace President Obama could offer these Native people on the centennial of our National Park Service.
Terry Tempest Williams' new book is The Hour of Land, A Personal Topography of America's National Parks. It is published by FSG. Terry, it's always a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for sharing with us, as always.
Thank you so much, Joe. And next time you're in Grand Teton or Yellowstone, give me a call. Our doors are always open.
It's lovely. Thank you so much. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Special thanks to Paul Ruest and Argo Studios. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.